were talking about the automated instruments and how they work. And I think we got to the red blood cell count and the RDW. So one of the things that you'll see on an automated instrument is the RBC histogram and count. And so it gives you the RBC, the hemoglobin, the hematocrit, figures the indices, and the red cell distribution width. So it plots out this little histogram. So you remember that RDW is an indication of anisocytosis. And so the histogram then reflects the size of the red cells. So if the red cells are big, then the curve goes more to the right. If the red cells are little, it goes more to the left. So this is a histogram, and the one that's normal there is the one in the middle. I guess you could say that. Not the one on the right. You don't have a point? Thanks. So this is the normal. So it's about 90, so right, 80 to 100 about. So if the cells are larger, it will shift it to the right. Okay, if the cells are smaller, then it will shift the curve back towards the left. So it gives you an indication of the size. Okay. We also have platelets that are done on the instruments. And so it'll give you a histogram of platelets, so the size again, and it'll give you the mean platelet volume. So the platelet histogram, it's done in the red cell aperture, the smaller aperture, and then you have to look at the difference between a red cell and a platelet. And so the mean platelet volume is the size of the platelet. And in order for that to stabilize, you usually don't do all of your CBCs just as they come in. It's not very efficient to do that anyway. After they're drawn, you wait anywhere from 1 to 4 hours so that the platelets can stabilize, and then you do them. Now, if it's an emergency, of course, then you don't care about the platelets. But in most cases, you wait 1 to 4 hours before you run the CBCs. So this is a platelet histogram. But now you notice the size of the platelets. So we're going anywhere from 2 femtoliters to about 10. So we're looking at the size of platelets. And they also will plot out then this the MPV, and you have to base it on a normal graph. It's called a nomogram. So if you have increased in platelet sizes, you'll remember that you see those in myeloproliferative disorders. You see the abnormally large platelets. If you have smaller platelets, it could indicate other problems. So we said in iron deficiency, for example, that you have smaller platelets and more of them. So the mean platelet volume helps in correlating with disease. The PD W is just like an RDW, except it's more platelets, so it indicates the variation of size of platelets. So normally, remember what a RDW normal is?
11.5.
Okay, somewhere 11, 13, somewhere around there. Okay, for platelet distribution width, the normal is less than 20%. So again, what you see will indicate some diseases that you might look for. The thing that's going to falsely elevate them is if you have red cell fragments. So schistocytes, they're going to be a little larger than a platelet, but can you see how it would go through and look like a really large platelet? So you just have to be careful and correlate that with your differential. Okay, Keila already talked to you about flow cytometry. Not all hospitals have flow cytometry available, but it's an instrument in some hospitals that you use for counting and measuring characteristics of cells. So the way this works is, again, you have an argon ion laser, and then you have cells suspended in a fluid. And then what you do is you tag the cell by using an antibody against an antigen that's on the cell. And so it tags it with the fluorescence, and then you measure the fluorescence. So this fluorescence, there can be different kinds, and you choose maybe two different kinds if you're looking for two different markers on the same kind. You can separate out an orange one from a green one. So there are different fluorochromes that we use. And then the cell travels through this laser beam, and it reflects and refracts light so that you get information about the cell size and the granularity, or you look for certain antigens that might be present on the cell. So when do we use these? Well, one of the really neat things they use flow for is to count reticulocytes. So you remember how tedious counting reticulocytes was? If you have a flow, you can do a reticulocytes count on that. Most of the places would be either looking for the immunophenotype, trying to classify a leukemia, or they may be doing absolute counts on patients that are immunodeficient. So they may be looking at CD4 markers or CD8 and seeing how many CD4 versus CD8. So the immunodeficiencies, of course, that we think about are Bruton's A gamma globulinemia or severe combined immunodisease or DeGeorge's. Those are all inherited. Most of the ones we do now are immunodeficient patients like HIV. So we use it a lot for that. We do have one at BYU. It's up in the Rick Center on the 8th floor. But we don't get to use it because they're quite fussy. Okay, I'm going to come back to the disease states if we have time. Okay, we're going to go through this one first, though. Because, as you know, these might be on the exam, so we better get through them. Okay, so the reticuloendothelial system, some people call mononuclear phagocyte system. And it's just a total mass of cells. We see it in the circulation because of monocytes that are circulating, but we also see it in tissues. And so this is the cellular and immunologic defense system of the body. So our phagocytic cells, not only the circulating monocytes, but we have fixed monocytes in tissues. We have histiocytes. We have macrophages that you find in the lung, the liver, the lymph nodes, the bone marrow, spleen. All of those are organs then that we call components of the RES system. So lymph nodes is an important component because the lymph nodes are filtering the lymph that comes through the lymph node, and of course we have a high concentration of lymphocytes in there that receive the antigens that happen to be carried. So a lymph node is encased in a little capsule, and the capsule has a continuous endothelial lining. So remember, all of our vessels are lined with endothelial cells. So there is a lymph vessel that penetrates through the capsule of the lymph node that's called the afferent lymph vessel, and it brings in lymph fluid then that we just call lymph, and it goes into the capsulary and it's filtered. So it drains into what's known as the subcapsular sinus, and remember a sinus is just an opening. And then it goes to the cortical and the subcortical regions of the lymph node, and then finally it goes to the middle that we call the medullary area, and then it dumps out into another vessel to go back out of the lymph node, and it's called an efferent vessel. So this is kind of a schematic drawing of a lymph node. So you see on the top the afferent vessel and on the bottom the efferent vessel. So it comes in one, goes out the other, and it goes through this system so that it goes from the outside to the inside and then gets picked up on the inside. So this is the capsulary on the outside. This is the cortex area, and then in the middle is the medullary area. So there are certain things that we see as far as the areas of the lymph node. This is just another schematic drawing so that you can see kind of how it's arranged. But what you see out here is the cortex, and then in the middle is the medullary area. So one of the things that we find out is that the lymphocytes can enter into a lymph node through these afferent lymphatic vessels, or you can see them coming through from the blood through the endothelial lining of the capillaries. And so the lymphs themselves can get into the lymph nodes. So the way that, again, they associate is they like to be in families. And so the T cells are found out in the cortex, and the B cells congregate in the germinal centers. So what we look for then as they drain through, so this is the pericardial areas right in here in between. This is the medullary area as it comes out. It flows in towards the middle. But the cortex, the outside portion, is where we see the follicles. And so it's called a primary follicle and a secondary follicle. And that's where the B cells like to be. And the T cells like to be in the paracortical, which means in between the cortical areas. And they associate together. Okay? So we're going to talk about diseases of lymph nodes in just a second. The other major player in the RES, besides the bone marrow that we've already studied, is the spleen. And we already talked about what the spleen does. It pits and it culls, right? So the functional parts of a spleen then are the white pulp, and these are the lymphatic tissue. So again, we have germinal centers where the lymph node or the lymphocytes are produced. And then we have red pulp where the phagocytes actually do their thing. And those are the sinuses or the capillary, the vascular channels or the cords. And then we have a marginal zone. And the marginal zone is real spongy. It's filled with blood cells, and it's kind of the in-between area that separates the white pulp from the red pulp. So if you look in your book, it's a little bit better drawing than mine. This is kind of a side view, but it shows you the marginal area. It shows you the follicles where the lymphocytes are going to sort of accumulate. It shows you the sinus areas where phagocytosis really takes place. And probably the best thing is as the blood flows through this artery into to other arteries, it goes through the marginal zone. They have to pass through into these little venous sinuses. And passing through there is just a really small gap. And so if we look maybe at a better schematic, up here are the sinuses, the openings, okay? But what has to happen is here's the cord or the arteriole. These red cells have to go through this little opening. And as they do that, they have macrophages that are watching. And so as they skinny through there, any imperfections are seen. And so if it's an inclusion, the macrophage just flicks it out, and that's called pitting. If it's an old red cell and it can't maneuver, it's going to be taken out because it's senescent. And the macrophage just takes the whole thing, which is culling. So that's the major thing that spleens do. So if blood pools in the spleen gets large. And that's splenomegaly. So what are the diseases we see associated with the RES? That's what we need to talk about. Well, one is called a lymphoma. Okay, a lymphoma is a cancer, but the cells are confined to the lymphatic tissue. They don't get out of the lymph nodes. If they do, if it spreads to the bone marrow and you see it in the peripheral blood, it's called a leukemic lymphoma. But the lymphoma would have already been there before that happens. So it's kind of an end stage of a lymphoma. So most of the time when a person says they have a lymphoma, that means that their cancer is confined to the lymph nodes. Okay, so we know what leukemia is. You know that that's when you have malignant cells in the bone marrow and in the blood. But a lymphoma means that it's just in the lymph vessel. So how do these people know they have a lymphoma? Usually it's an enlarged lymph node somewhere. Okay, we used to have a faculty member up in MM Bio who the only abnormal lymph node he had was right under here. just a really small lymph node. And he knew that wasn't normal. And finally, they did a biopsy and found out he had lymphoma. And his progressed so fast in about 9 months that it got into the bloodstream. And he was gone in less than a year. So it's not a good thing to have. There are two kinds of lymphomas, and we call them either Hodgkin's or non-Hodgkin's. So Hodgkin's lymphoma is more common in males than it is in females. It peaks at about the third decade, but you'll see teenagers that have Hodgkin's lymphoma. And what they have is a painless lymph node. So it's not, you know how you get lymph nodes that are swollen and they hurt because you're filtering out bacteria or viruses or whatever? These are painless ones, so they're just enlarged. They may have cough or chest discomfort. One of the things that's pretty common is any kind of malignancy, you lose weight. I mean, it sounds like a wonderful thing to happen to you, especially if you're a woman. But if you're losing weight for no reason and you're not trying to, it's not a good sign. So they wake up and they have these drenching sweats during the night. And they have fever. These are some pictures of lymph nodes that are enlarged. Now, these are pretty advanced, okay? So if we're talking about Hodgkin's lymphoma, most of the time these cells originate from the follicle, the follicular area, and they're B cells. Okay? So if we see these patients, and we don't very often see them in the lab, because if they just have a swollen lymph node, they may do a CBC. But the only thing that you might be able to see would be about 25% of them might have a slight increase in white cells. And if they have anything, they might have an absolute lymphocytosis. Some will have eosinophilia. And that's probably the most common thing that we see, is they'll have increased eosinophils. They usually don't have anemia, and they don't usually have a decrease in platelets. Okay, if they think this is Hodgkin's, they don't do bone marrows. Okay, the only time they're going to see a bone marrow infiltration is in the last stage of a lymphoma, so they don't do that. They can immunophenotype the cells if they are in the bone marrow. What they do is to do a lymph node biopsy. So they do an incision, take a lymph node, and what they're looking for, and it's called pathognomonic, means it's almost always an indication of Hodgkin's if you see a Reed-Sternberg cell. So pathognomonic means almost always. But remember, in medicine, you don't say always and you don't say never. Because as soon as you do, somebody will show up with what you said wasn't there. Okay, so you look for Reed-Sternbergs. And if you remember what a Reed-Sternberg looked like, it was a big cell. It had eosinophilic inclusions all in it. It had nucleoli with a real definite membrane around it. And it looks like a two... mirror image nuclei. So it looks like owl eyes, right? So if you see owl eyes in a tissue biopsy, this is a lymph node biopsy, this would be pathognomonic of Hodgkin's lymphoma.
How do they do the lymph node biopsies?
They just make an incision and take one out.
Do they just take part of it out, or do they take it?
They take it all.
Okay.
They're small.
We usually get these. It's on the pathologist.
We don't usually get them. But, you know, if you see the eosinophilia, they'll bring it in so you can see the Reed-Sternbergs. But these are sections. Okay. So the way they classify patients that have Hodgkin's is by a couple of different things, and you don't really need to remember this, except that they classify them to the extent of how many lymph nodes, or what's the infiltration, and how many Reed-Sternberg cells are there. So this is called the Rye classification. And so the different classifications give different prognosis for the patient. So if you were classified as a lymphocyte depletion, it's real rare, but it means you have a real poor prognosis. So again, the pathologist does this. They also use the Ann Arbor staging, meaning that they look at how many parts of the body are affected, how many lymph nodes. And so they do 1, 2, 3, 4. So you see that number 4 right here is all over. So it usually starts in the neck. This is a stage 1 where it's confined here. Then it goes to the medial spinal area, goes to the axillary. Then it goes below the diaphragm, and that's not a good prognosis. Okay, so what do we see in the lab in a patient who has Hodgkin's lymphoma? Okay, what we see probably will be eosinophilia, but almost everything else is pretty normal. Okay, we see the lymph node biopsy, then they can either immunophenotype it or we just look for Reed-Sternberg cells. But you really ought to know what a Reed-Sternberg cell looks like.
Allies.
So when you look at a picture with owl eyes looking at you, think Hodgkin's. Okay, what do they do for them? Most of the time they can give them radiation therapy. Sometimes they'll have to do a combination chemotherapy, and sometimes they can do bone marrow transplant. But most patients, if they catch it early, radiation on the neck area works. Okay, if you get a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, again, they're B cells in 95% of the cases. The symptoms are about the same, fever, weight loss, night sweats. And again, they classify them according to the cells that are there. So again, the pathologist looks at them, decides what kind of cell it is, and then you have low grade, intermediate grade, and high grade. Okay, so here again are some non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. So they start out with cervical lymphadenopathy usually. Okay, there are some rare ones that we've been talking about. And Keila told you about mycosis fungoides, that it starts as an infiltration of the skin, and so it was diagnosed because it looked like a fungal disease. And then we find out that it can progress and become what we call Sézary syndrome. And these are T cells. So in this Sézary syndrome, when you have pruritus, you have skin that thickens, the lymph nodes are infiltrated, it can progress so that the viscera are infiltrated and it can actually spill out into the blood into the leukemic phase. So these people, when they first start out, they just have a, looks like a skin disease. It's itchy, it's dry, it's kind of red. They get infections easily. It's usually seen in males. It's not too common, but they're, if you remember, I think this weekend's the run for President Lee that was president of the university. Okay. He had Sézary syndrome. Okay. And one of our faculty in our college now has been treated for Sézary. So it says it's uncommon, but I already know two people. So, you know, median age is about 55 years. This shows you then the lesions that you usually see on the patient. So you notice they're kind of reddish. They look dry. You wouldn't think it's a malignancy. It's not a real common thing to look at. Okay, when it goes into the systemic phase, then you see this proliferation of T cells. And when it happens that way, it's almost impossible to treat. So what are you going to look for? And you're going to see this in blood when it spills over. You're going to look for the Sézary cell, right? Or Sézary cell. So do you remember what they look like?
Brains.
Brains, yeah. They look like they've been cut through, right? Or lobulated. So if you see a Sézary cell, you think what disease? Sézary syndrome. Okay, so in the bone marrow, you might see an increase in eosinophils or plasmacytes or monocytes, and you hopefully will see Sézary cells. And then, of course, you can use cytochemistry to prove that they're T cells. You can immunotype them so that you can actually do the CD marking. And this is what the lab sees. You look for those hyperconvoluted lymphoid cells. They do the marrow. You see more of those lymphoid cells or you immunophenotype, and then they have Sézary syndrome. Okay. So those are lymphomas. So they start out confined to the lymph node. Another type of disorder that we see that's associated with the reticuloendothelial system are the lipid storage diseases. And so the definition of a lipid storage disease is that these macrocytes in one or more of the tissues of the body become overburdened with lipids. And they don't stain very well because they're full of lipids. There are two types that we see in bone marrow cells. So that's why we talk about them in hematology. Gaucher's disease and Niemann-Pick's disease. So what the problem is in these conditions is that you have a large macroglobulin that contains a lipid. And in this disease, you inherit the inability to make the enzyme that breaks that down. And so it backs up and you have too much macro molecule lipid. And then they start to deposit in the tissues. So the most common one we see is Gaucher's disease. So these patients have infiltration of these macrocytes in the spleen, the liver. They actually have bone destruction. They get pigmentation of skin. They have purpura and abnormal bleeding. And any place in the RES, you can pick up these Gaucher cells. So this shows you the involvement of the spleen and the liver. So the drawing is how far down the spleen and the liver are extending in this patient. So you can see that it's hepatosplenomegaly. I told Jeannie her liver was a little too low yesterday. She got it in the wrong place, but that's okay. Okay, so Gaucher's disease is the most common of the storage disorders. So it's inherited as an autosomal recessive, and what you have is a deficiency of the enzyme that's called beta-glucocerebrosidase. So it can't break down the glucocerebroside, and so that accumulates in the macrophages, in any of the RES system. So you can see it in spleen, lymphoid tissue, liver, bone marrow. And so in hematology, we see it when we have a bone marrow. Now, there are different kinds of Gaucher's disease, 1, 2, and 3, depending on when it develops and how severe it is, meaning how much of the enzyme is missing. Okay, so if it occurs in infancy, of course, that's a lot more serious. They usually die by at least 2 years of age. So that's a very serious disorder. So what do we see in the lab? We're going to see most likely a pancytopenia. So they're going to have decreased whites, decreased platelets, and have anemia. So in the bone marrow, what you're looking for are Gaucher cells. So these cells are large. They have a small eccentric nucleus. They have kind of a clump cytoplasm that's filled with pale-staining lipids. So it's supposed to be like looking at onion skin. Okay, so these are the types of disorders you're going to see. So this is Gaucher's disease, showing you an adult and a child. But notice the hepatosplenomegaly. It's huge. This is the cell that we're going to try to find. This one's under phase microscopy. But that's the kind of onion ring fibrils that you're looking for. So when you stain them, these cells are huge. So this is a 10X, and you're looking at all of these Gaucher cells in this marrow. So this is a neat one we got from somebody, again, so you can see how large those cells are. So this is only 10X. So when you see that big a thing, you think, okay, it's either a megakaryocyte or something weird like this. So a small eccentric nucleus. Here they are close. So the nucleus is eccentric, but see all these kind of fibro lines in the cytoplasm? That's all lipid. And so this cell's been engorged with lipid because it can't break it down. So when we diagnose it in a lab, maybe the only thing we're going to see is a pancytopenia. We might see this lymphocytosis. They do a bone marrow, and we see Gaucher cells. So in order to confirm that, they're going to have to test for the absence of the enzyme. And so glucocerebrosidase is decreased. Okay, the next most common we see that's associated with hematology is Niemann-Pick. So these people, again, it's a storage disease. They have the splenomegaly, the hepatomegaly. Usually it manifests itself early on in childhood, so they have an impaired mental development. And for some reason, about one-third of them have this cherry red spot on the macula of the retina of the eye. This one affects girls more than boys. So here is our Niemann-Pick disease right here. So look at the hepatosplenomegaly. Okay, mentally retarded. Here's a phase microscopy of the Niemann-Pick cell. So this one's a little bit different. You get an accumulation of sphingomyelin. That's the lipid that accumulates in the macrophage. So the enzyme that's missing is sphingomyelinase. So again, we have usually leukopenia, thrombocytopenia, anemia being manifest. And then we have Niemann-Pick cells in the bone marrow. So these Niemann-Pick cells are filled with sphingomyelin. So they look a little bit different than a Gaucher cell. So this, again, is a huge cell. Okay, its nucleus, a little bit eccentric, but now you see kind of globular rather than fibril inclusions. And again, it's the sphingomyelin that's in there. So we do the bone marrow, we identify the Niemann-Pick cells, then we have to prove by doing a sphingomyelinase test, and it's decreased, and it would be Niemann-Pick disease. Okay, what do we do for these? Not really anything because it's inherited. They do splenectomy sometimes if the spleen starts hanging down too far. Okay, another storage disease that we see occasionally is a storage disease called mucopolysaccharidosis. And so now what we have are deficiencies of enzymes that break down mucopolysaccharides. And so again, they're inherited. One of them is X-linked. Hunter's syndrome is X-linked, but the others are autosomal recessive. And there are different enzyme deficiencies depending on which disease you have. But they all have then an accumulation of the mucopolysaccharides. So remember we talked about Hurler syndrome, Hunters and Hurlers? Yeah? Alder-Reilly bodies? So what we're going to see are these accumulations of polysaccharides. So not only does it happen in cells, but it happens in all the tissues as well. So remember Hunter and Hurler is the one we talked about, gargoylism, right? Kind of. You know what a gargoyle is? Okay, well, they have that kind of face. And they're usually short. They have skeletal abnormalities as well. They have deafness, can't walk very well. They're retarded as they try to walk. They have mental problems. It depends. The symptoms depend then on the type of mucopolysaccharide that's present. But they, again, have hepatosplenomegaly. So it deposits there. So gargoylism, it's called that because of their facial characteristics. But in their leukocytes and histiocytes, they have Alder-Reilly or Reilly bodies. So remember what they look like. Here's a patient that housed the condition. So kind of a face distorted, many, many problems. So look for Alder-Reilly bodies.
This is the weirdest
Not that I know of. Okay, so look for the presence of Alder Riley bodies. Remember what they look like? Look like they've been shot, so they're really heavy. So if you took buckshot and just shot that cell, that's what it would look like. It's not toxic granulation, right? Okay, so what you're going to see in the lab will be probably the large platelets, but you're going to look for the Alder Riley inclusions. And then the way they confirm that is to do urine tests for mucopolysaccharides. So if you work in a primary children's hospital, for example, you'll do a lot of screening for these kinds of diseases because kids come in, they don't really know what they have. They look funny, but, you know, you got to figure out what's the problem. So, again, you can't do much for it because it's inherited. Sometimes stem cell transplantation will work. Okay, this one you needed to know yesterday, but we never got to it. But Keela said that she had talked to you about it a little bit. Do you remember it? No? Okay, sea blue histiocytosis. Again, it's a storage disease. Okay, some of them have neurologic damage. They have big livers and spleens. And again, it's inherited. And their macrophages fill up with this blue or blue-green granule in the cytoplasm. They have not identified any specific enzyme deficiency. And so usually it's just something that you see and they don't have a problem. But I think she might have mentioned it to you in maybe CML. There are some conditions that will produce sea blue histiocytes. But if it's an inherited disease, they the histiocytes then store this material that's greenish-blue. It's called a ceroid. And there are other conditions that have the same kind of thing that are secondary. So those are a list right there of all the diseases that could produce it. I think she talked to you about it in CML. So you're not going to see anything, but if they happen to do a bone marrow for some or other reason, you're going to see these sea blue histiocytes. These are, again, really large cells. They have the eccentric nucleus, but now their cytoplasm has this nice blue or blue-green granule. So here's a nice sea blue histiocyte. From what?
Purple.
Purple? Purple what?
The granule is really purple.
Oh. Well, what else could it be? No, not a megakaryocyte, because you'd see platelets. These are actually big crystalline materials.
Does it usually look like it has ruptured cytoplasm?
They're really hard to find, and you notice how dense they are around the edges. You know, this is a bone marrow, so these are really clumped, but it could have pushed it. But they're not real easy to find. Okay, it couldn't be a megakaryocyte either. How many nuclei does a megakaryocyte have? Most of the time. More than 8? Yeah? At least more than 4. Okay, so in the bone marrow, then you're going to see this sea blue histiocyte. Okay, we don't usually need to treat them because there's not much wrong if it's inherited. If it's another disease, then you treat the other disease. Okay, there are some other histiocytic tumors that we're just going to mention, just so that you know. These are cell histiocytosis. And so I'm just going to mention their name. There's one called an eosinophilic granuloma. And these people have bone lesions. And what you're going to see are histiocytes and eosinophils, hence the name eosinophilic granuloma. And then it seems like as you get these different diseases, you just add one more problem on top of it. So now you get a patient that has bone lesions, but it's also moved to the viscera. They have this inflammation or this infiltration. They get the skin lesions. And again, what they have are histiocytes and eosinophils. and they call this the Hand-Schuller-Christian disease. So these are granulomas, and you see eosinophils and histiocytes. So again, here's a bone marrow biopsy, and you see eosinophils and big histiocytes. Okay, this one's even worse. Now what you see is it happening in children below the age of 3. They have lymphadenopathy, splenomegaly, hepatomegaly. They have bleeding. They have skeletal lesions, the bone lesions. They have fever, pulmonary involvement, edema. So it's worse. It's called histiocytosis X, or the letter or seaweed disease. So it's just building more disease. So here's a little kid that has letter or seaweed. Okay. We did it. Now I'm going to go back to the cases I had for you. And you probably already looked at the answer. You cheated. Okay, what I'm trying to show you here, and on, is tomorrow Friday already?
Yes.
You do have some of these on your test. Be happy, you're going to know the answer. Okay, so what you're looking at is the gray. So the gray is the normal, okay? So here's our white cell histogram. Here's our red cell histogram. Here's our platelet histogram. So if we look, this thing is shifted to the right, and which means bigger cells, right?
Would that indicate, wait, what's the little red on the other side? Would that be like dimorphism?
Oops.
So
okay, we have platelets too, which if you have smaller things, they're going to come here. This is the red cell that we're really looking at.
So it wouldn't necessarily indicate dimorphism?
Not below 40. Okay, but now you have the case history. So it's a 33-year-old white female who's after a renal transplant and splenectomy being seen in an outpatient clinic. So you see macrocytosis because of the shift. Since the transplant 18 months ago, the patient has been receiving an immunosuppressive drug to prevent rejection of the transplanted kidney. She developed a macrocytic anemia due to the drug, and it caused megaloblastic erythropoiesis. So then you look at the results and see if it makes sense to you. Her red cell count is 2.55, hemoglobin 11.6, hematocrit 34, MCV 134. Okay? So what you see in this patient is 14 nucleated reds per 100 whites. You see a NESO, you see macrocytes, you see poikilocytosis, only slight, polychromasia slight. Because remember, in megaloblastics, it's not usually a prominent thing. Many Hal Jolly bodies. Retic is pretty normal, isn't it? 1.9? But she should be reticking more than that with that anemia. So this is what you see on the smear. So what are you looking for here? Macrocytes, and they're pretty big, aren't they? Here's a lymphocyte. But you're looking for oval macrocytes, right? Okay, what's that? Okay, a nice Hal Jolly body. Okay, so what you're trying to do all the time is correlate. Does this person's disease match what you're seeing in the lab? Okay, here's the next one. Megaloblastic due to chemotherapy. Probably folic acid if we were to guess, right? Because it has to happen quite quickly. It's only been 18 months. Okay. What do you see on this one? Okay. Look at also right here. Okay. So then you read the case. This is a 2-year-old white male seen in an institution's pediatric outpatient clinic for pallor and lethargy. See a severe microcytic hypochromic anemia. Okay. Further testing, you do the irons, right? So you expect the iron to be decreased, the TIBC to be increased, the percent sat to be less than what? 15%, okay. Now, the patient history indicated poor nutrition with a high intake of artificially flavored food drinks. Sounds like you guys. No.
What?
Okay, you see the serum iron? 8 micrograms. What's the normal? 50 to 150. Okay, you see UIBC. You see a ferritin level. Less than 5%. So it's pretty easy, right? What's the MCV? 58. Okay, MCH 16. MCH C 28. Hemoglobin 8.5. Okay. No wonder he has lethargy. Okay, so what do you see on the smear? Does it correlate? So hypochromic, and look how little they are. Okay, so iron deficiency. All right, what do you see on this one? Okay, let's look. 38-year-old white male complaining of fatigue and night sweats. Referred 3 years ago following a hematologic evaluation which included a bone marrow aspirate and biopsy, and diagnosis of CML was made. He was followed as an outpatient for 2.5 years, after which time a sharp decrease in the white blood cell count was noted and a marked basophilia appeared. Several months after the appearance of the basophilia, the patient transformed into a blast crisis and expired 7 weeks later. Okay, so what we're looking at are these. So for CML, what are we going to see? All stages, right? So we're going to see metamyelocytes, myelocytes, promyelocytes, probably some myeloblasts. Okay, one of the things that happens is they have a lot of uric acid. They have so much production of cells and breakdown of cells. They have uric acid, and uric acid causes gout. So you see a deposition of uric acid crystals in the joints, so it becomes real painful. Okay, so that was the CML. Look at this one. Okay, decreased white blood cells. 43-year-old male admitted for the evaluation of pancytopenia and splenomegaly. Following a bone marrow evaluation, they noted what he had. They had to use surface markers and cytochemical staining. But if you look at his white count, it's 2.4, reds 3.35, MCV 97, okay, platelets 81, okay. Okay, remember in acute leukemias, and some of you really need to remember this, in acute leukemias you have a decrease in what? Platelets. Okay, almost always, when we say leukemia, everybody thinks you have high white counts, but almost all of the acutes have decreased, or at least normal. So here's this peripheral. Don't you wish you could see hairy cells like that?
Yes.
Okay, so, good luck. Katie, are you okay?